Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining the Working and Keeping Benefits conference call. Your host for today is Ms. Brenda Brown. Ms. Brown, you may begin.
Thank you very much, Alma. Hi, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to our teleconference tonight. The call tonight is being recorded, so use only your first name when you speak to ask a question. The format will be that Steve will give his presentation and questions to follow. If you'd like, you can write down questions as we go along. All lines will be muted until you have a question to ask. Once the question is asked, your line will be muted again, so formulate your questions accordingly. I'd like to introduce now Steve Nissen, who is the Senior Director of Employment and Community Programs at the National Capital Chapter of the National MS Society in Washington, D.C. He's also the Director of Operation Job Match, the Employment Assistance and Support Program of that chapter. Before coming to that National MS Society, Steve worked extensively in the vocational rehabilitation field. He worked as a rehabilitation counselor for the Virginia Department of Rehabilitative Services, the state vocational rehabilitation agency. In addition to his experience in the public sector, Steve worked for a private vocational rehabilitation and case management company where he provided job development and placement assistance to individuals with physical disabilities. Steve has a BS degree in psychology, a MS degree in rehabilitation counseling, and is a certified rehabilitation counselor. He recently co-authored Employment Issues and Multiple Sclerosis, second edition, which is available from Demos Medical Publishing. So, Steve, I'd like to turn over the teleconference to you now. Thank you for joining us tonight. We appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much, Brenda. I do want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to join you all tonight. I just wanted to mention this is a WebEx webinar as well. So for those of you that are following along online, I will be advancing my slides, and if time permits at the end, we'll be pulling up a couple of the websites. So to get things started, the agenda for tonight's call, again, we're really going to be focusing on employment issues and MS, working and keeping your benefits. So whenever I talk about any type of employment call, I always want to just kind of talk briefly about the relationship between multiple sclerosis and work, the reason that people leave the workforce, then really get into the disability programs, Social Security disability programs, the work incentives, the programs available from Social Security that might be available to help you to return to work, and then some of the other common employment concerns that people with MS experience when considering returning to work, dealing with disclosure and accommodations. So to get things started, what we know, there have been several research studies done throughout the years really focusing in on the employment considerations of people that are living with MS. You know, we always realize that work is more than just about a paycheck, but it can relate to your self-esteem, self-identity, sense of self, not to mention the obvious benefits, paycheck, oftentimes medical insurance, those sorts of things. The research shows that about 90% of people with MS have worked. At the time of diagnosis, the number of people that are working is about 60%. You jump ahead several years, 5 to 10 years after the diagnosis, the percentage of people still employed drops to about 40 to 43%. And that's actually a slightly higher number than previous studies that were done back in the 1980s that showed that about 30 to 33% of people with MS were still employed that 5 to 10 years following the diagnosis. So there's been a gradual rise in the percentage of people that are still employed. This is most likely due to better treatment options, symptom management. Again, you know, back in the 1980s, there were no FDA-approved treatments. And then also some of the legal protections. The ADA, which is a law that I'm going to just briefly be talking about later, that law wasn't passed until 1990. So probably the combination of those two things, as well as just greater awareness, both for people with MS as well as the employer. So there's been a gradual decline, but when we have surveyed people that are not working, again, the majority that are not working oftentimes they say that they would like to be working, and that rate of not working is oftentimes higher when compared to other chronic illnesses. So there are definitely some kind of specific characteristics to people with MS when it comes to employment. The next slide just lists some of, I guess, what we think could be the reasons that people are leaving the workforce. We're not 100% sure that these are the reasons, but this is what oftentimes I hear when working with clients with MS, when we've surveyed them. What we know is that many times the person with MS is leaving voluntarily and leaving prematurely. It doesn't mean that people might not be fired or terminated, but oftentimes people are leaving of their own choosing. The reason that people might be leaving, again, I'm not going to read these word for word, but legal protections, disclosure concerns, might not know practical ways to accommodate your symptoms on the job, the invisibility of the symptoms. One thing that I point out here, significant others in the person's life tell the person to stop working, saying that work is too stressful. I hear this still from people that I work with, their doctors or their family members. What we know is that unemployment does not cure stress. In fact, it can lead to another entire level of stress in terms of the limitations with finances or lack of medical insurance or planning for your future retirement. So, again, don't do anything prematurely. Not working does not necessarily reduce stress. There are ways, there are practical things that you can do, which I'm going to talk about later, which will hopefully allow you to work for as long as you choose. Don't know of the appropriate resources, transportation, because we know that definitely transportation can be a big barrier to employment. So oftentimes people do decide when they do separate from the workforce to go onto a disability benefit, whether it's Social Security or a private disability insurance policy. So that kind of leads us into really kind of the primary focus of tonight's call is working and keeping your benefits. So just a quick kind of tutorial when it comes to disability for those of you on the call that might not be on Social Security. The definition of disability according to Social Security Administration is a very kind of specific definition that is based on your inability to work. And Social Security Administration considers you disabled if you cannot do the work that you had been doing before, that you cannot adjust to other work because of your medical condition or conditions, and that your disability has lasted or that it's expected to last for at least 1 year or to result in death. That sounds very extreme, but that is definition from Social Security Administration. I include this because it's important to realize that the definition of disability may be different if you're looking into other laws or protections like the Americans with Disabilities Act or the ADA, which again, I'm going to briefly talk about that later. The definition of a person with a disability is very different than what Social Security considers to be disabled. The crux of Social Security is that a person does not have the ability to work, or at least not work at a competitive level, which is what's called the substantial gainful activity, which I'll be giving those figures here shortly. So Social Security Administration, they oversee two different disability programs, Social Security Disability Insurance, SSDI. That is basically a disability insurance program. So you, as an employee, were insured when you were working. And that if you've ever noticed, like on your pay stub or on your paycheck, the FICA amount that is taken out of your pay, that is what's being put into the Social Security Trust Fund, the Social Security system. Generally, to be eligible for the SSDI, a person needs to have worked for 40 quarters, so you can get up to 4 quarters per year. And so not only do you need 10 years of work experience, basically, but you also need a certain portion of that experience has to be recent work history. So generally speaking, 5 out of the past 10 years you need to have been quote-unquote insured, meaning putting into that Social Security system. The other Social Security disability program, Supplemental Security Income, SSI, again, you still meet that same definition of disability that I mentioned on the previous slide. The definition of disability is the same, but the main difference is that Supplemental Security Income, SSI, oftentimes might be for someone who has limited work history. They have not put in the necessary number of quarters to get to that insured level. Part of Supplemental Security Income also is that it is more of a needs-based program, so a person needs to demonstrate financial restrictions as well. Medicare is the insurance coverage that comes with Social Security Disability Insurance, SSDI. There is a 2-year waiting period for Medicare. Medicaid is the insurance that comes with Supplemental Security Income, SSI, and there generally is no waiting period for that. So what I hear oftentimes, I work with a lot of clients that are receiving a disability, and I mean, this is really the crux of tonight's call, the next slide. Common questions that people have: what will happen to my benefits if I do go back to work? Not only the cash payments, but my medical insurance, my health care coverage. What if I do return to work and I find that I'm not able to continue to work? What will happen then? What options do I have? What things should I be thinking about when returning to work? This is not only the work incentives, which we'll be getting into next, but really those other general employment concerns, disclosure, accommodation strategies, those sorts of things. And where can I turn to for help? Know that throughout this process, you are not alone. You do not have to go through this process by yourself. This slide, I gave the link to the Social Security, what's called the Red Book. This is really the primary resource publication that deals with work incentives under Social Security, which I'm going to be talking about next. So for the purpose of tonight's call, I'm not going to go into an exhaustive list of all of the work incentives that would be available to you under the Social Security program. I'm going to talk about a resource that you can utilize in order for them to run a personalized analysis. But I'm going to kind of highlight the top 4 or 5, and talk about those now. So once a person is receiving Social Security Disability Income, again, SSDI, that's what the next 6 work incentives are going to be focused on people that are on that benefit, SSDI. Trial work period. The gist of the trial work period is this is a period of time, 9 months, they don't have to be consecutive, that a person can basically earn as much money as they want and still retain their full benefits, both your cash benefits and your insurance if your Medicare has kicked in already. The 9 months do not have to be consecutive. It's 9 months out of 60 months, so that's 9 months out of 5 years. And what constitutes a trial work period month is any month that your gross income goes above $720 a month. So again, during that trial work period, you can make as much money as you want and still receive your full benefits. 9 month period of time. At the conclusion of that trial work period, so then what comes into play is what's called the substantial gainful activity, or the SGA. Once a person has exhausted the trial work period, they do get 3 more kind of additional months grace period, but after that, Social Security looks at your gross income. And if your income is above the SGA, or the substantial gainful activity, your benefits will be affected. What constitutes the SGA for 2011 is $1,000 a month gross income. For people that are deemed blind, according to Social Security Administration, that figure is $1,640 a month. So again, just to kind of clarify how those two programs work together, 9 months I've been working, I've been making a considerable amount of money, I've been able to retain my full benefits, I get those grace period months. Then Social Security is going to look at, if my income is above $1,000, my benefits are going to stop. It's not a gradual thing. It is an all or nothing when it comes to Social Security disability insurance. There is some pilot programs going on. That's called the Bond Program. It may be in your state. I can try to give you their website at the end. But this work incentive works. If a person's gross income is above $1,000 a month, or $1,640 if you're considered blind, your benefits will then cease. Okay, on to the next slide. Another SSDI work incentive. So again, I've now stopped receiving benefits because I've been able to work. I've exhausted my trial work period. I'm above the SGA, so my benefits stop. But what happens if down the road I find that I cannot work again because I've had an exacerbation, new symptoms have come up? So the next slide talks about the extended period of eligibility. After the trial work period has been exhausted, for 36 months you can work, and for any month that your income falls below the SGA, you will receive your SSDI benefits. So again, that's a 3-year period of time that if your income drops below the SGA, that $1,000 or $1,640, then you'll get your check again, and you don't need to reapply. No new applications needed. The expedited reinstatement of benefits is an even longer period of time that basically you would have up to 5 years to reinstate your benefits if you find that you are not able to continue working. So, again, I've continued to work. It's my 4th year, maybe. And I find that I am not able to continue to work at the capacity that I was before above the SGA. They can put into effect the expedited reinstatement of benefits, which will reinstate your benefits. No new application is needed, but you will still have your medical condition reviewed by Social Security Administration to make sure that you still meet that definition of disability. A little caveat here about the SGA and things of that nature. Just think of that as being kind of the threshold. If long-term your income is above that $1,000 or $1,640 a month gross income, then your benefits will be affected. But if your income is below that, you will continue to receive your benefits. So I work oftentimes with people that might be looking to work part-time to supplement their disability income, and the magic figure to keep in mind is $1,000 a month. Long story short, that's a key figure to keep in mind. If what you're thinking about doing is you don't want to risk losing your benefits but want to try to return to work but maybe only work part-time, as long as you keep your income below $1,000, you should be able to retain those benefits. Next slide, again, two more work incentives under the Social Security Disability Insurance SSDI program. Continuation of Medicare. We know that for people with MS, maintaining medical insurance is critical. When a person's benefits have stopped due to their earnings, Medicare Part A will continue for at least 93 months. And again, these slides, there's very particular months and figures here. Definitely review the slides. I think that you were also sent them beforehand. So Part A will continue. 93 months is 7 years and 9 months. Can't tell you how they came up with that period of time, but that is what Social Security does when it comes to maintaining Medicare Part A. If you were enrolled in Part B, which is the outpatient services, and or Part D, which is the prescription drug coverage, you must continue to pay the premiums. After that period of time, the 93 months, you can continue to buy into Medicare by paying monthly premiums for all of those sections, Part A, Part B, and Part D. If you are younger than 65 and you still have the condition, the disabling condition. So there are ways that you can continue to maintain your Medicare coverage even though your cash benefits have stopped. One final work incentive under the SSDI program, which is a kind of creative way that might be utilized to impact your gross income, is what's called the impairment-related work expenses. These are basically any expense that you pay for out of pocket in order to work. So, for instance, say I've exhausted my trial work period, I'm now above the SGA, so I'm bringing in $1,200 a month, but I pay $300 a month for accessible transportation to get me to and from work. That is an expense that I need in order to work. Using that as an impairment-related work expense, you can deduct that $300 from your $1,200 a month gross income, which then brings your gross income down to $900 a month, which is less than $1,000, which is less than the SGA. And I'm using that just, you know, as a to try to make a clear example. So there are ways that if you are paying for certain things out of pocket, it can't be covered by insurance, it can't be covered by any other organization. These are things that you are paying for out of pocket in order to work that can be subtracted from the gross income, which then oftentimes can bring your gross income below that SGA amount. Note that the impairment-related work expenses does require pre-approval from Social Security Administration. The other ones that I mentioned do not. So we know that the next slide kind of talks about just a few of the Supplemental Security Income, SSI, work incentives. I'm not going to go into as much detail with those work incentives because oftentimes, well, a couple things. One, we know that oftentimes, given that MS is an adult onset disability, many times the clients that I work with and that we work with have significant work history, so they might be on the SSDI. SSI also sometimes, for instance, you know, Medicaid, those sorts of things might actually vary based on jurisdiction. So I'm going to just talk about three kind of quick SSI work incentives. So the first one, earned income exclusion. Really, when it comes to the SSI, what this means is that there's no real trial work period when a person is on SSI. When a person returns to work at all, then that benefit, that monthly check, that cash benefit can be reduced. So again, SSDI is kind of like an all or nothing. If you're above the SGA after your trial work period, your benefits stop. With SSI, it's not necessarily that cut and dry. There's a formula that is used, and again, the slide kind of gives an example. Social Security does not count the first $85 of your monthly earnings. They then deduct from your SSI payment 50 cents of every dollar that you earn after that $85 deduction. So say, for instance, that a person is making $1,000 a month. They subtract the $85. That brings you down to $915. You divide that by 2 because it's 50 cents per dollar. That figure is $457.50. A pretty common SSI cash benefit amount is $674. So you take that $674 minus the $457.50, your benefit check would then be reduced to $216.50. So again, it's a very complicated formula. The resource that I'm going to talk about next can definitely do a personalized analysis so you can really fully understand what this means. But the gist of it is that if a person is receiving Supplemental Security Income, SSI, their benefit check is going to be reduced until they reach a certain level that then it's going to completely wipe it out. The impairment-related work expenses, which I mentioned on the previous slide, these can be used also with the Supplemental Security Income program. One last work incentive or program under the SSI program, PASS plan, that would allow a person to set aside money to pay for certain things that you need in order to reach a goal. So if you're making money but yet you're paying for certain things, that can be kind of set aside so it does not count towards that your monthly income. This does require pre-approval. There's a formal process that a person goes through. Moving on to the next slide, Ticket to Work program. Just a couple words about the Ticket to Work program. This was a program that went into effect in the late 1990s. Really, the gist of the Ticket to Work program is giving you greater consumer choice. You can go to what's called an employment network, which is basically a vocational rehab provider, a community agency, to provide you with vocational rehab support services. Sometimes that could involve training, job development, job placement assistance, interview role playing, assistance with your resume, providing medical equipment, a variety of different services that would be available to you. So Ticket to Work allows you to go to an employment network, your state vocational rehabilitation agency can also accept your ticket. When a person does get approved for Social Security, they get a ticket in the mail, the letter that says, this is your ticket to work. You don't need to use it. It's completely a voluntary program. Again, on the slide, I give you the website, www.yourtickettowork.com, or their phone number. On their website, it does list the employment networks that would be available to serve you. It really is your choice. I do always encourage that if you're considering using your ticket, basically interview the employment networks. Find out what types of services that they provide. Find out, be thinking about what sort of support services that you're looking for to return to work and if that community resource provides it. You ultimately have the choice to pick who you work with. That's just a brief word about the Ticket to Work program. One of the, though, outgrowths of the Ticket to Work program is what's called the Work Incentives Planning and Assistance, which is also known as the WIPA. Again, Social Security, they're all about the acronym, so I know that you've heard me mention a lot of different ones so far, but the WIPA program is the resource that I was mentioning that can basically work with you. It's a free service that you can work with someone that's called a Community Work Incentive Coordinator, or a CWIC, to run a personalized analysis of your benefits. And what those Community Work Incentive Coordinators do is really help you understand the impact that work will have on your benefits. Again, I mentioned some of these work incentives already tonight, but they are the experts when it comes to really knowing all of the ins and outs of all of the work incentives that might be available to you. The slide talks about what is available at your local WIPA program. I strongly encourage that if a person is receiving Social Security benefits, SSI or SSDI, get informed. And the WIPA program, your CWICs, is the best source of information to know what impact that work would have on those benefits before you do anything. So next slide some other things to take into consideration if you are returning to work is your legal protections. So I just very briefly, on this slide, just mention four of probably the most common laws that people with MS would want to familiarize themselves with. The Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, is a civil rights legislation that's supposed to prevent against discrimination of people with disabilities in a variety of different settings, the workplace, the employment arena. That's considered to be Title I of the ADA. Again, that idea about definition of disability, a person with a disability under the ADA is a person with a mental or physical impairment that substantially limits one or more of a person's major life activities, has a history of such impairment, or are perceived as having an impairment. So again, Social Security looked at not having the ability to work. The ADA really looks at that it affects one or more of your major life activities, seeing, hearing, walking, thinking, those sorts of things. So this law does apply to private employers with 15 or more employees. Some of the bullet points here, major life activity, the essential job functions. The ADA says that you do need to be able to perform the essential functions of your job, but you can request a reasonable accommodation. I'm going to give you some examples. Those are modifications or changes that you might benefit from in order to help you manage your symptoms on the job. The employer can deny those accommodations if they say that it causes an undue hardship, if it's extremely expensive, if it's disruptive. But what we know is that oftentimes the accommodations that benefit people with MS don't cost a lot or might not cost anything. Just a couple of sentences about the Family Medical Leave Act. Again, another law that is would allow a person job-protected leave. It's job-protected leave without pay that a person can use for up to 12 weeks. Those weeks don't need to be consecutive, so you don't have to take it all at one time, but you can take it here, you can take it there. A person does need to have worked for their employer for at least 1 year, and that employer must have 50 or more employees. A key thing to remember about the Family Medical Leave Act is that this law offers protections not only to the person with MS or the medical condition, but to their family members as well. So if a loved one is caring for you, if you're going through an exacerbation or the diagnosis process and your loved one might be missing time from work, they might also be able to tap into Family Medical Leave Act. HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, I include this primarily as it relates to pre-existing condition clauses. This is when a person has had group health insurance, has been covered under a group policy, and maybe changes jobs, changes employers, goes from a group plan to a group plan. HIPAA deals with minimizing that the pre-existing condition clause on the new insurance coverage. So as long as that person has had coverage for 12 months on their previous insurance and there's not a significant gap or significant break in coverage, under HIPAA, 63 is the magic number. If a person has a break in coverage of 63 days or more, that new insurance plan can impose a pre-existing condition clause. If a person is facing a pre-existing condition clause, that new insurance could limit expenses for those pre-existing conditions for up to 12 months. So again, 63 days is the magic number. If there's no considerable break in coverage of 63 days or more, and a person's going from group plan to group plan, that new insurance plan should not impose a pre-existing condition clause. COBRA, Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act, it's a mouthful. This is basically a law that allows people to continue on their employer-sponsored health insurance. Generally speaking, 18 months is the typical period of time that COBRA can be used. In some situations, it can be extended for 29 months, sometimes up to 36 months. This is oftentimes the case, especially if a person is leaving work due to their disability. They've applied for Social Security. Then oftentimes COBRA can be extended for at least a 29 months. With COBRA, you maintain your previous employer-sponsored coverage, but you are responsible for all of the premiums, and the employer can tag on some minimal administrative costs as well. So this could be a costly option, but it could be utilized to also maybe cover that period of time if you're changing jobs until that new insurance kicks in. Going to talk about disclosure here for just a couple seconds. The next slide kind of talks about the disclosure dilemma. Again, when a person's thinking about returning to work. Getting informed, getting educated is what's key. So disclosure oftentimes comes up. Disclosure does have its pros and cons. It's a very personal choice. I cannot tell a person to disclose or not. Oftentimes what I say in working with someone is, okay, what's going on that's making you think that you want to disclose or that you shouldn't close, whether it's to a prospective employer or to a current employer that you've been working for and then you've been diagnosed or you're experiencing new or different symptoms. The advantages, I think, again, the slide pretty much says it all, pretty self-explanatory, reduces stress, allows you to inform others about a mess, allows you the opportunity to request accommodations. The ADA does deal with disclosure and accommodations. The ADA says that you don't need to disclose if you can perform the essential functions of your job. But if you do require accommodations in order to do your job, then you do need to disclose. So it's kind of a double-edged sword that on one hand here's this law that says you don't need to disclose, but if you actually want the protections that are available to you, then you do. So again, disclosure definitely relates to requesting the accommodations. It also just make you feel more comfortable. I think, you know, the cons of disclosure, I think the ultimate fear is that people are going to lose their job, they're going to be pigeonholed, they're not going to be considered for promotions, and just want to maintain your privacy. But again, this is very much a personal choice. Usually disclosure comes either maybe when a person's symptoms are changing, going from maybe invisible to visible, when they need some sorts of accommodations, when you're missing time. Those are some of the situations that might spark a person to want to disclose. Next slide, some tips on disclosure. Keeping it simple. Disclosure comes down to the who, kind of who is the appropriate person. Is it my direct supervisor? Is it someone in my HR department or personnel? When is the correct time? What do I want to say and why? What is the reason that I'm considering disclosing? I oftentimes with the clients that I work with here in the metropolitan Washington, D.C. area do kind of come up with almost like a disclosure script, disclosing the condition, relating it to your symptoms, requesting the accommodations, and finishing on a positive note. Those are the four general components of a disclosure script. So, for instance, an example, if I have difficulty writing because I have a tremor, but I can really, that tremor isn't really affected when I'm using a computer, I might say to my employer, you know, I would like for you to know that I have MS, and in my situation it affects my ability to write clearly, but if I can take messages on the computer, then I know that then I know that I'll be able to work effectively and keep up with the calls that are coming in. For instance, say maybe I'm a secretary. It can be that simple. It's just putting it out there, but you really want to finish on a positive note. With this accommodation, I'm going to be able to do my job. I'm going to be very effective. I'm going to be productive. The reality is when it comes to disclosure and accommodations, you play a major role. It is not the employer's responsibility to see that you're struggling and to say, hey, what can we do? It's your responsibility to think proactively about disclosure and accommodations. The next slide, I'm not really going to go over this because, again, this really just lists some of the common symptoms that we know people with MS do experience that can impact them on the job. So some examples when it comes to some accommodation strategies for some common symptoms. We know that fatigue, probably the most common symptom. So practical accommodation strategies, flexible work hours, combining breaks, taking a rest period. I've worked with some clients who take a nap during their lunch hour. They shut the door, close the blinds, and their employers are fine with that. Cognitive symptoms, I think that's really kind of looking at the distractions that you might be experiencing. the nice thing is that technology nowadays, there's a lot of built-in accessibility features, reminders, bells and whistles, things in Outlook that can prompt you to-do lists, those sorts of things. Heat sensitivity, something as basic as just keeping a fan on your desk or wearing a cooling vest. I think the next slide lists fine motor, gross motor, vision difficulties. The thing to remember is that definitely these common symptoms can be accommodated, and oftentimes they are not costly. The last slide, when it comes to examples of accommodation strategies, again, utilize technology, assistive technology, Dragon Naturally Speaking or other voice recognition software can be a great benefit, trackballs, flexible work schedules, telecommuting, working an adjusted schedule, an adjusted work week. Know that your accommodations, what you need, might vary from time to time when you're having symptoms, when you're not, when you're going through an exacerbation, when you're not, when new symptoms pop up. So this is definitely something that that you might need to think about, not just one time, but on an ongoing basis. So the last thing I want to talk about in the last couple minutes before we go to the Q&A, the next slide kicks off, I guess, let's see here, four slides on don't do it alone, the resources that are available to you. I'm just going to highlight some of, I think, kind of what I think. I mean, definitely these are all very important and useful resources. Otherwise, I would not have put them in this presentation. But know that the National MS Society, we are a source of information. We have publications about employment issues, about disclosure, about accommodations, not only for people with MS, but for their employers as well. So, again, you know, our toll-free number, no matter where you're, no matter where you live, 1-800-344-4867 connects you to your local chapter and our website, nationalmssociety.org. I give the specific links in the presentation about the employment page and the interactive disclosure tool. If time permits, I'm actually going to pull that up later. That is part of our website where it kind of talks you through what are you thinking when it comes to disclosure. Why are you thinking about disclosure? What are your reasons? Who is the appropriate person? What are you going to say? So it's really a nice tool for you to use when you're grappling with that choice. The next slide, Job Accommodation Network, amazing resource about accommodation strategies as well as your legal protections on the job. They also provide information and services when it comes to self-employment for people with disabilities. So again, their website I gave on the slide, askjan.org or 1-800-526-7234. This is a federally funded program by the Department of Labor, Office of Disability Employment Policy. They've been providing this information for since the, I want to say, early 1980s. Wealth of information publications, not only on MS, but on the ADA, on disclosure. You name it, they are an amazing resource. The other good kind of legal ADA information are the ADA Technical Assistance Centers, also known as the DIBTACs. I do list three job boards for people with disabilities. Oftentimes people, if they're looking to return to work, might want to work for an employer that they know going in is disability friendly. So things like getting hired, National Business and Disability Council, DisaBoom jobs, these are all job boards that employers post job vacancies that are for job seekers with disabilities. The next slide, just highlight the EEOC is the enforcement agency of the ADA, of Title I of the ADA. So if a person feels like that they are being discriminated against on the job, that would be the agency for you to contact. The State Vocational Rehabilitation Agency, I mentioned them before. They are in every state. They provide comprehensive vocational services to assist people with disabilities in gaining and and in maintaining employment. The last resource page is really focusing on the Social Security resources. Social Security's website, socialsecurity.gov, or their toll-free number, 1-800-772-1213. I mentioned the WIPA program before. Again, on the slides, I give the website for you to find your local WIPA program. So definitely take some time to review the resources. Last slide. Just again, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to me tonight. And I guess with that, Brenda, I'm open to see if we have any questions.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if there's any questions you have, please press the number one key on your phone. Again, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone now. Our first question comes from Dina. Go ahead, Dina.
Hi. My statement is I'm confused because I'm trying to be self-employed and do my own thing.
Mm-hmm.
They told me if I make $38, they're going to take that away from me. So I'm confused. How can I make money if I make $38, they're going to take $38 away from me? So every penny I make, they're going to take away, and so I can never get above the money that I'm currently making?
Social Security work incentives are very different for people that are self-employed. That is something that I do not have readily available, but I would encourage you to definitely contact your WIPA program and talk to a community work incentive coordinator. They would definitely be able to explain to you how the work incentives are utilized when someone is self-employed. I should have actually clarified that. The work incentives that I was talking about are for kind of traditional work experience, not for self-employment. Again, that is kind of beyond the scope of my area of expertise, but your community work incentive coordinator would definitely be able to clearly explain the self-employment rules to you. So I apologize that I didn't prepare for that, but definitely contact your
SBA. Where do I get that?
If you go to, in order to find your WIPA program, if you go to socialsecurity.gov/work, if you are on the WebEx, I'm going to pull up their website right now and share my desktop with you. If you go to pardon?
I said, does this get saved? Yay.
If you go to socialsecurity.gov/work, and then on the left-hand side where it says receiving benefits, the next link underneath that says service provider directory, and then you click on that, and this is then the state-by-state listing, and so you can see, I don't know if you're online, but you can see it says WIPA. And then if you find your state, click on the WIPA link, and then that will pull up the contact information for your local WIPA program.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have any questions you'd like to ask, please press the number one key on your phone now. There are no further questions.
Okay. Just to give people a few more minutes if they can think of any questions, for those of you that are following on the WebEx too, I wanted to just show you some of the resources that I mentioned. So currently I'm sharing with you the Job Accommodation Network, JANS, website. Again, the web address, askjan.org. And if you click on the A to Z of disabilities and accommodations on the top of the page, and then click on by disability, this basically lists kind of, you know, all of the types of fact sheets and conditions that JAN has information has information about. So if you scroll down to multiple sclerosis and pull it up, they have a variety of different fact sheets and accommodation ideas specifically for people that are living and working with MS. This first link, accommodation and compliance series, employees with MS, again, you can definitely, you know, print this out as a PDF, as a Word document, but let me scroll down to show you. One of the most exciting things about this publication is that it lists common symptoms that we see with MS and bullet points practical accommodation strategies. So again, cognitive impairment, fatigue, weakness, fine motor impairment, gross motor impairment, heat sensitivity, speech impairment, vision impairment. Like I said before, the responsibility for coming up with these accommodation strategies falls on you. So do your homework. Contact Jan. Look at their website. It is great information. And the other site that I wanted to just briefly show is the National MS Society's website. I'm actually going to type in the shortcut for that disclosure tool, which again is nationalmssociety.org, disclose work. And that's the shortcut that will pull open this interactive disclosure tool. And as you can see on this right-hand side, should I tell, kind of what are your reasons for thinking about disclosure? Who's the right person? Whom should I tell? How much should I tell? And kind of conclusion in terms of, okay, now what? So this is a really good site to use if you're grappling with the disclosure dilemma. The other site is just our main employment page, which I'm pulling up right now. And as you can see, there's different sections disclosing information. That's what I just showed you. Knowing your rights, again, some of the legal protections, workplace decisions, what sorts of things would you want to think about before you do anything. So again, there's take some time to explore the resources that are available. And oftentimes, again, we at the society, we know of also community resources that can provide employment assistance. So if you can't find your state vocational rehabilitation agency, the MS Society may have their contact information. So I was thinking maybe, Alma, if we want to poll the audience one more time to see if there's any further questions.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have any questions, please press the number 1 key on your phone. Again, to ask a question, please press the number 1 key on your phone. There are no questions at this time.
Okay. Brenda, was there anything else that it looks like that we've got maybe five more minutes until the top of the hour? Was there anything else in particular that you wanted me to address?
I think you've covered everything, Steve. If there was any other websites that you wanted to show
okay.
us, I think you've shown us the ones that you...
What I can quickly try to do, if it's not going to be too quick, I was going to pull up one other one, not Social Security, but... let's see here.